Where does free culture come from, and where is it going? Answers to these questions and more on this week's Radio Berkman. Free culture activists believe in a future in which people will be free to remix and redistribute creative works like literature, movies, music, software, and images. These are the folks who can toss around phrases like free as in speech versus free as in beer to illustrate distinctions in legal code. Seriously. Even with entrepreneurial free culture initiatives like Creative Commons breaking into the mainstream, the movement is still very much in its infancy, and there are many questions left to be answered. How are creators motivated in a free culture environment compared to a traditional commercial market? Does private property still mean anything in the commons? Does a music file get treated differently than a piece of software? Is there any real difference between the act of sharing a music file and the act of pirating a music file? Or is it just splitting hairs? These are questions without definite answers. That's why researchers, activists, lawyers, bloggers, coders, educators, and multi-hyphenate combinations thereof gathered at the Free Culture 2009 Research Workshop at Harvard University. Gabriella Coleman is an assistant professor of media culture and communication at New York University who has been both studying and assisting in the progress of the free culture movement and helping to answer some of these questions. She sat down this week with our guest host, Elizabeth Stark, to split some of the hairs of the free culture movement, discuss its origins, and pontificate about its future.
There are different locations of free culture, but a good way to then find those locations is to think about, like, where did it come from? The web allows for a lot of sharing, but then there was a very strong kind of political movement around software that became an icon that kind of gave a moral philosophy instead of licenses, that then was adopted by all sorts of groups in different domains, right? And so in some ways, free culture has an ancestry, which is both kind of explicit and implicit. Implicit being the sharing that goes on in the web. And so that ancestry matters because I think there's ways in which you can identify all sorts of projects, you know, the most famous being Wikipedia, which is explicitly organized around this idea of freeing knowledge and culture through the avenue of licensing. And obviously the work of Creative Commons has really helped in that regard. But then there's this sense, and I think it's correct, that there's all sorts of other forms of sharing that have to do with cultural material, music, comics, videos, that's not explicitly organized around the idea of free culture as a philosophy. Yet researchers locate that as examples of free culture.
So how much then do you think the philosophy of the free software community can be applied to the cultural realm? And can it? I mean, not even how much. Can it actually be applied?
It has already been applied, right? Other genres present some difficulties. So maybe to give an example, photography is something that people allow people to remix and so on and so forth. Now, in the world of free software, there's a big commitment that once you open something, it's okay if a corporation takes it and contributes to it. And if they do, it is often a boon to the developer because they've added value. When it comes to photography, on the other hand, let's just say you take a great picture that then Adidas picks up for whatever reason, and then they slightly remix it, and then they make $5 million. Well, the remix of the photography doesn't necessarily add anything back to you. It can at some level. So there's that sort of difference that I think matters. And that's one of the reasons why I think a lot of people pick the non-commercial licenses for Creative Commons, which some people have criticized as, well, you know, there's no clear standard. But you can also say genre matters in terms of how things circulate. So that's one way to look at this issue.
There's also been a good amount of discussion on the interplay between free culture and piracy, and you mentioned that you'll be teaching a related course next semester at NYU. I was curious as to your thoughts as to whether piracy can ever come within the domain of free culture, and if so, how?
Digital piracy online has produced a commons. I mean, let's talk about book piracy today. It is unbelievable, the amount of books being shared, combined with, in the case of ARG, discussion. There's actually a community, but it's illegal, full on, right? And so there's definitely this legal commons and illegal commons. And I do think it's important to recognize the kind of similarities and differences. In some ways, the pirate commons is valuable precisely because of its transgression and its message that sometimes the law is overbearing. And legal solutions, even laudable ones like Creative Commons, are not simply enough. And so from my kind of more activist perspective, I think a healthy ecology has both kind of legal and illegal kind of modes of organizing, as opposed to playing a politics of the authentic versus inauthentic modes of sharing.
And what are you seeing as any reaction in the free software communities to the increasing role of piracy? Granted, it's been 10 years now since Napster, right? So maybe we can argue as to whether or not it has increased or decreased. What is the general sense in the free software community vis-a-vis the piracy issue? Not only with regard to software piracy, because generally that would not encompass free and open source software, but in the cultural realm as well.
Individually, there's a whole range of commitments. Some free software developers think that you shouldn't pirate music. You know, if it's under a copyright, you should respect it. Yes, they would prefer that artists put something under a non-copyright license. Others think that given the ease of transmission and the ways in which there's other forms to generate commercial value, that you should let it go. So one thing that I have seen with books is that it's knowledge. I do see a slightly higher percentage of free software developers who say it's knowledge and it shouldn't be closed off. Music is not quite knowledge, right? And so there's a few prominent developers whose names I won't mention, but they've been really involved with book ripping projects, making it possible to optically scan books in a very short period of time and throw it online. And so the kind of we can do it, and knowledge should be free, but are less willing to go there for music. Again, huge variability in the community, but it's still nonetheless interesting to see whether they support music piracy less or more than something like book piracy, which is truly taking off right now. And I think one of the most interesting issues will be, will the publishers have the legal / financial muscle to do something about it in the way that the RIAA and MPAA have been able to do with music and movies?
Right. Well, I guess one question is whether the Book Publishers Association will go and start suing either individual infringers or sites for secondary infringement that are hosting a massive amount of illegal infringing books. I think that you're right in that this is really still on the fringe. It's not, for example, at least most people that are somewhat tech savvy and connected to the internet have used a peer-to-peer file sharing applications such as Kazaa, BitTorrent, or so on. Whereas with regard to the book sharing communities, things are still relatively obscure.
But can you imagine when and if thousands upon thousands, hundreds of thousands of college students go, okay, my bill for the semester is $250 for these books, or I can download them and read them perfectly on my reader or on my computer. So it'll be really interesting once the undergraduates kind of get wind of this, because it's a huge pool of people. But again, we can't predict the future and see what will happen, but this is a trend that I think we're going to have to look after.
Well then, how do you think the open educational resources and open textbook communities can address this potential opportunity?
You know, I don't think we should just be comfortable with, let's just let piracy rule. I do think it has its value in all sorts of ways. But at the same time, it is an opportunity for traditional publishing to rethink their models of delivery and revenue. And they do have to look to open publishing in very serious ways in order to kind of counteract the piracy, right? If they want people to come to their sites, if they want to make some money, there's different models by which to do this. And it's everything from getting subsidies from universities to charging very low prices for e-books. I mean, this is one of the very interesting things about the history of peer-to-peer music sharing, is that there was kind of an explosion. And then when iTunes came about and charged 99 cents, peer-to-peer music sharing dipped considerably. There was still a kind of techno elite doing it, for sure, but they learned that, you know, the average customer is willing to pay money so long as it's easy and cheap.
Some people do not feel that 99 cents is necessarily cheap when you're going to fill up a 60 gig iPod and that could cost tens of thousands of dollars, but...
It's true. I think it could be even cheaper, you know, way cheaper, and they would actually increase their revenues. But I really think about this. I think, well, what if an academic publisher charged $5 per ebook? I think a lot of, especially academics, would say, all right, I can buy 20 books for very cheap, and I'm willing to do that. But all of a sudden, when it's $20 and then you've got this, you know, treasure trove or whatever on the internet, people will turn there unless there's a kind of crackdown, which I think that there will be at some level. It is unbelievable the amount of books that are now available.
Up to now, we've seen a large uptake in free software. For example, I recently asked a class of my students how many people here use Firefox. Every single person raised their hand, you know, at least on a regular basis. And there has been a large uptake, but it has not necessarily, it's not that every single person in the room knew that they were using a piece of free and open source software on a daily basis. And I'm curious as to how much you think that this political consciousness that has developed in the developer community will reach the mainstream. And do you think that within the next 5 or 10 years, this will be something that we're all aware of in the way that maybe we're all aware of, say, environmentalism today?
That's a great question, because environmentalism, even with students who don't care, they certainly know about it, right? And the key markers and the key players, Greenpeace and so on and so forth. And you're absolutely right, free software is not there. What is interesting is that it went from like an extremely enclave phenomenon for well over a decade to then something that exceeded the enclave with the work of people like Larry Lessig and many others to bring it to other domains, right? But as you know, it's still kind of limited, even though people are interacting with it, touching it with Firefox. The conditions under which a more expansive political consciousness around it could form is if and when something like Ubuntu, which is a desktop Linux distribution, becomes so widespread that all of a sudden it is an option for people. If that is the case, I would be surprised that then people who were considering, I'm going to consider Ubuntu as opposed to Windows or Apple, they would then go, well, what is this Ubuntu thing and what does it mean? So the condition of possibility is the wide circulation of something like a desktop operating system.
By the way, we are seeing at least an increased availability of Ubuntu on netbooks in particular.
That's a great point, and that may be one viable route. And I do think, I mean, any political program often takes over a decade to really bring into fruition. And technological artifacts such as Ubuntu, which have really gotten so much easier to use. And I think in another 5, 10 years, it will be phenomenally easier to use. So if it really then does present itself as a true consumer option in the sense that it's 50% of people using it, I do think at that point people will have to ask, well, what is this thing and why does it have such a funny name, right? And then start to learn about some of the politics of it. But you're absolutely right. It's not like the environmental movement where people have a sense of what that is, even if they're not directly involved with it.
So availability may be the key, and usability to awareness of free software.
And more than just individual programs, in a sense. The operating system is your entreeway into your whole computer, and people are very comfortable with the fact that, like, Apple operating systems kind of have a culture to it, right? And Microsoft is often seen as, like, the cultureless operating system. And then if you have a cultural operating system, a cultureless operating system, and Ubuntu then is a real player, it's going to be seen as that. Well, what is it then? It's like the political operating system, right? So, but it's got to circulate in a much, much, much wider capacity than it does right now.
Great. Well, thank you so much. We're really excited to have you here today.
Thank you.
Gabriella Coleman is an assistant professor of media culture and communication at New York University. She is currently completing a book called Coding Liberal Freedom, Hacker Pleasure and the Ethics of Free and Open Source Software. You can find her on the web at gabriellacoleman.org. If you visit the reference section at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman, you'll find links to more of Gabriella's work, background information on the free culture movement, and archives of this show. This week's episode was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with the help of the distinguished Elizabeth Stark, Amr Asher, and the organizers of the Free Culture 2009 Research Workshop from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge.